So Ecclesiastes chapter 11 and in verse 9. There the writer admonishes the young man, "Rejoice, young man, during your childhood, and let your heart be pleasant during the days of young manhood. And follow the impulses of your heart and the desires of your eyes, yet know that God will bring you to judgment for all these things. So remove grief and anger from your heart and put away pain from your body, because childhood and the prime of life are fleeting." Let's pause there for a moment. Now, I know that the writer is addressing maybe several issues here, but among the things that he has to say, if I could draw out at least one lesson, is that he is giving advice on how to age gracefully, on how to live a life so that when you get to the end of that life, you are not eaten up with sour attitudes and bitterness and regret. And he does so, I think if we look at the book as a whole, he does so in a way that's not denying that there are going to be difficult issues. He doesn't try to pretend like everything in life is going to be just fantastic every day. And yet what he says is that there's a way that we can get to the end of our lives that looks back on the choices that we have made, and it affects the way that we're going to see them. It affects the way that those have shaped us as people. And if we look at end of life, we might say that generally speaking, in a very broad sense, when people get to the end of their life or the latter portion of their life, you can generally put them into two categories. You can say that they are either grateful for the life that they have lived, or you find someone who is very bitter about the hand that life has dealt them. Now, maybe there's some room for some in-between, but let's just say for now we're looking at those two ends of the spectrum. Now, both of those have seen their share of loss. Both of them have seen their share of tragedy, and yet they can look at life and it's a very different outcome. And so how is it that they get to such diametrically opposed places? Well, one of them is capable in looking back at all of the difficulties that life may have brought upon them, and they can still see God's goodness and His mercy and His grace, while the other sees a void. They see the absence of those things. And so how can I learn to be more like the first while trying to stay far away from the second? Well, that's largely what we're going to be looking at for the next few days together. Just a little bit of a preview. I think you probably already have this on your meeting announcement. But tonight is going to be the first in a series about looking at bitterness. Now, we'll actually talk in the third lesson about why we have a whole series on this subject instead of just maybe a one-off lesson. But each of these is going to be building on the other until we finally look at how bitterness unchecked can ruin and wreck a congregation of God's people. Now, in our lesson tonight, if you have the handout or if you've looked at the announcement, you know we're talking about Joseph. But in looking at the life of Joseph, we are looking at someone who had every opportunity to embrace bitterness, to be overcome by attitudes of bitterness. They became the very personification of victimhood. But instead of reading the text and finding this individual as being destroyed or eaten up with bitterness of heart, you find that each increasing passage or each increasing difficulty only brings someone closer to thriving under the grace of God. And so I'd ask if you would to go ahead and start out and turn with me to the book of Genesis. We're going to read a selection of chapters from Joseph's life, and we're going to start in chapter 37. Again, Genesis chapter 37, if you turn with me there, I'm going to start reading in verse 3. "Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a varicolored tunic. His brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, and so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. Then Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, 'Please listen to this dream which I have had. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose up and also stood erect. And behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf. Then his brothers said to him, are you actually going to reign over us? Or are you really going to rule over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Let's pause there for a moment in Joseph's life. Bitterness as a problem or a situation is something that usually thrives on extenuating circumstances. You know, even when it's under the best of circumstances, let's say we're dealing with someone who is completely innocent. They have been wronged in some way that was no way their fault, and that bad experience can cause their life to be forever altered. In other words, they never are able to move past it. They always look on that instance as what defined their life. But even worse than that is when we have an individual whose situation, their difficulty, has been brought about by their own choices, but they still attempt to justify their sour attitude about where they are in life by an appeal to circumstance. That you just don't understand why I'm justified in being bitter the way that I am. And I think that one of the most enduring conspiracies, or rather one of the most enduring extenuating circumstances, is an appeal to conspiracy. That when someone is eaten up with bitterness and you try to approach them, they say, listen, no one is on my side. No one understands where I'm coming from. No one wants to help me. In fact, everyone seems as though they are out to get me. And so if nobody likes me and nobody wants to help me, how can you possibly expect that I can thrive under these circumstances? Now, in our lesson tomorrow, we're going to see examples of men like King Saul who had confrontations with others over their choices and interpreted it as violent opposition. But for now, we're simply going to say that this claim that everyone is out to get me is very seldom actually paired with any real intent or malice on the part of others. And yet, having said that, here in the life of Joseph, we have a pretty good example, a genuine example of someone who could, for all practical purposes, have said, nobody likes me. Everyone is out to get me. Now, I view Joseph as being an entirely innocent party. Now, sometimes people will look at Joseph and say, maybe you're the older sibling. And you look at Joseph and you say, well, you know, he just seems like he was being kind of ratty. And maybe he just kind of got what was coming to him because he was over here boasting and bragging. I don't really give that much weight. I think I look at the text and I imagine, let's be real here for a moment. Imagine that you are 16 or 17 years old and you start receiving visions about the future from God. Do you suppose that you're going to keep that a secret to yourself? I mean, that's just the kind of thing that even if you tried, you couldn't keep to yourself. You're going to tell somebody about it. And I don't think that we would be willing to commit to the idea that the retaliation of his older brothers at first plotting to murder him and then throwing him into this Egyptian exile was somehow a punishment that would fit his alleged crime. But I say all that to say that Joseph here does fit that bill. He's an innocent victim. People conspired against him, and the vast majority of his own family did not even like him. And so for the moment, setting aside what you may already know about the story of Joseph, perhaps ask ourselves the question, how might we have responded to similar treatment? Would you have grown bitter? And we'll be asking that question a lot. But I want you to consider this question in the light of Genesis chapter 39 and the first two verses. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, so he became a successful man. And he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now, understand for a moment, I am not in any way suggesting that Joseph, once he got into Egypt, did not experience fear and anxiety, because that's exactly what he went through. I'm not trying to say that this was somehow pleasurable accommodations. And yet here he is, having been betrayed, sold out by his own family. He arrives in a foreign nation under the worst possible circumstances that you can imagine. And how do we read about him being presented in the text? We find someone who is thriving. We find someone who is finding success. Now, we'll explore that in just a moment, but I want us to read a little bit further in the same chapter. In chapter 39, let's drop down to verse 13. This is after Potiphar's wife has tried to ensnare Joseph. And in verse 13, after he's fled, when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled outside, she called to the men of her household and said to them, "See, he has brought in a Hebrew to us to make sport of us, and he came in to me to lie with me, and I screamed. When he heard that I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me and fled and went outside." So she left his garment beside her until his master came home. Then she spoke to him with these words, "The Hebrew slave whom you brought to us came in to me to make sport of me, and as I raised my voice and screamed, he left his garment beside me and fled outside." Now when his master heard the words of his wife, which she spoke to him, saying, "This is what your slave did to me," his anger burned. So Joseph's master took him and put him into the jail, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the jail. But the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him and gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. Now, understand that when I say what I'm about to say, I'm not making light of anyone's situation. But when anyone goes into the prison system, they never, or at least they seldom, admit that they are guilty. Everyone who has to experience the prison system always operates under the same banner: I am innocent. I am not supposed to be here. Now, understand, I'm not being trite, because sadly, that is often the case, perhaps a frightening amount of time. You know, how many people were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time and are now suffering because of that? Or how many people have been falsely implicated in something that they never had anything to do with in the first place? You know, occasionally, you know, maybe it's on YouTube or Netflix or whatever it is, but occasionally you read one of these stories about someone who has been in prison for 40, 50 years before evidence comes to light that exonerates them. And then they're released from the prison. And yet, what are they supposed to do with that 40 or 50 years that's been taken from them? You know, even if a local system is held accountable and they have to pay, you know, how can you accurately put a price tag on the years that have been stolen from someone's life? You can't do that. And because of that, even when people have a positive attitude and they say, "Look, I'm just thankful to be out. I'm going to make the best of this opportunity and start living my life now," it is difficult for them to maintain a positive outlook, because you simply cannot pretend that that didn't happen. You can't erase it from your mind and make it go away. And for people in those situations, bitterness is a constant struggle. And so what I think makes Joseph's situation particularly difficult, well, first of all, this is building on top of what is already an unjust situation. He's been betrayed, he's been sold into slavery. But the second thing that makes it so awful is that not only had Joseph not committed the crime of which he had been accused, but Joseph's behavior in reality was as far as you could get away from the crime that he had been accused of. And so imagine again, you're Joseph, you are trying to put the past behind you. you have been betrayed, sold off, but now you're here. You're here in Egypt. You're going to do the best that you can do. And so you are entering into the house of Potiphar, and you're going to serve with a good attitude. You're going to be the best steward you can be. And what does it get you? What is your reward for doing what's right? Well, you get betrayed again. You're falsely accused. Your reputation is ruined. Any sense of honor or respect that might have been bestowed on you up to this point, it's gone. And now here you are in the prison. Now again, if we can set aside for the moment what we already know about the story, this would be the part where I would assume that Joseph is going to throw up his hands and say, I tried. I gave it everything I could, and look where it got me. Instead, what we see of him when he is placed in the prison is once again God blessing him. I'm not saying that to sort of override as though he is not bitter only because God blessed him. I think God is continuing to be with Joseph because of the type of character that he is. He is cooperating with God's grace. He is willing to work and serve in whatever circumstance he is in. Again, understand, I'm not pretending that this is some sort of vacation. A jail is a jail, no matter how nice it may seem. But instead of having resigned himself to some form of victimhood or extreme anger, once again, we see that Joseph is thriving in the environment in which he has been placed. Well, let's look forward in Genesis chapter 40. We're going to start reading in verse 20. But you'll remember that in chapter 40, Joseph is approached by two of his cellmates, prison mates, however you want to think of that. And both of them have dreams, and Joseph interprets the dreams. He says that the butler, the cupbearer, is going to be restored and spared while the baker is going to be put to death. And the request that Joseph makes is that once the cupbearer is restored, that he would mention Joseph's case to the Pharaoh. Well, in Genesis chapter 40, in verse 20, we read, "Thus it came about on the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, that he made a feast for all his servants, and he lifted up the head of the chief cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among his servants. He restored the chief cupbearer to his office, and he put the cup in the Pharaoh's hand, but he hanged the chief baker, just as Joseph had interpreted to them. Yet the cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him." I have to imagine that as bad as Joseph has had it so far, this had to just be a crushing, a devastatingly depressing chapter in the life of Joseph. You have endured so much up to this point. You have conducted yourself honorably. You've given it your best. You have, you know, frankly impressed everyone whom you've come across. And finally, now is the opportunity. You have been put in a position to have a friendly ear before those in authority. They're going to state your case. You know, I kind of imagine Joseph on that third day, waving goodbye to the cupbearer, you know, shaking him on the hand. "All right, buddy, you know, this is your time. When you get there, don't forget to mention me." You know, I don't know if he wrote him a little note and put it in his shirt pocket or what he did. But then he starts waiting. And the days go by and no one comes to check on Joseph. There's no postcard from the cupbearer. There's no rumors or rumors of rumors that Joseph might get to come before the Pharaoh soon. You know, how long do you suppose that it took Joseph before he decided no one's coming? Nobody is coming. I'm still alone in this prison. In spite of my work ethic, in spite of my kindness in helping my two fellow prisoners as much as I could, nobody is with me. Now, again, eventually the cupbearer remembers. Pharaoh has a dream and somehow rings a bell. You know, honestly, I don't know how the cupbearer forgot him so quickly, but now he remembers. And so Joseph is called for. He's cleaned up, he's made presentable, and he is brought before the Pharaoh. Again, I want you to imagine, you know, not just how Joseph might have handled this situation if he was not of the character we know him to be, but how might you have handled the situation if finally, after all of this time, now they drag you out of prison to come before the Pharaoh? You know, if it were me, I would carry on. I might just sit in my cell and refuse to go. You know, what took you so long? I've been sitting here all this time. Or, you know, maybe just be a smart aleck and, you know, all right, well, I'm finally glad you remembered me. Maybe I would hold myself kind of hostage and I'll interpret your dream. But we need to settle the score with the cupbearer before I do anything for you. Again, you can go on and you can imagine that. You know, you might want to get revenge on Potiphar's wife, anyone who had wronged you. Just take me back to prison. That's where I'm going to end up anyway. And yet, when we read what happens in chapter 41 and verse 14, then Pharaoh sent and called for Joseph, and they hurriedly brought him out of the dungeon. And when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came to Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Joseph, I have had a dream, but no one can interpret it. And I have heard it said about you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. Joseph then answered Pharaoh, saying, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. Now, I'm not trying to read too much into what Joseph has to say here. And yet, I am at least impressed not only by his willingness to help, but by the fact that when he goes to help, his mind is already in the position of, I'm nothing special. Anything that happens is going to be because God did it. God is the one who will give you an answer. And so I think as readers of this narrative, we are supposed to ask, and indeed we must ask the question, how is it that Joseph is able to keep this attitude? Why has he not yet succumbed to being bitter, to being angry about life? Again, yes, God has been with him every step of the way, and yet God has been with him in a pit. God has been with him in a slave caravan. God has been with him as he's been a servant in a household and falsely accused and thrown in a dungeon. It's not as though he's been on a beach vacation with God. God has been with him through a very difficult time. But I think the answer is in the perspective with which Joseph is able to look back on the life that he has lived. And I think bitterness in particular always has a certain way of looking back. One looks back on their lives, and not only do they remember every ill they have suffered, perceived or real, but they dwell on it. And all they see in the difficulties that have experienced or that they have experienced in their life, all they see is sort of one big conspiracy against them, that life has been unfair. At every path and every juncture of their life, others have acted toward them. Forces were against them. And as Jacob would describe his life shortly, their days have been few and full of evil. I think that this applies not only to those who seem to have gotten to the end of their life and have very little in the way of physical possessions to show for it. It even applies to those who are rich at the end of their lives, but they are unable to move on. For Joseph, his life had moved on quite a bit. You know, there are a lot of positive things that have happened in his life. He's going to be married. He's going to have children. But eventually, he's going to be reunited with his brothers. A famine is called, or a famine is caused, rather, and he calls his brothers, or his brothers are sent to him, and he calls them in for a meeting. In chapter 41 and verse 51, we are sort of going ahead here, and I want you to take notice of Joseph's children. Joseph named the firstborn, again, Genesis 41, verse 51, Joseph named the firstborn Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household. He named the second Ephraim, for he said, God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. So the reason why I want to look at the names of his children is because I think it colors the way in which we see his interaction with the brothers. Sometimes people, again, sort of view Joseph as being sort of cruel and manipulative in the tests that he puts his brothers through, as though this is sort of his opportunity for revenge. But I think that Joseph is testing their character. He's seeing the kind of men that they have become and how they have moved on with their lives. And aside from just the emotion that is so raw and real when he reveals himself to them, I have to interpret it in light of what we read here. Joseph is not a bitter person. Do you remember when the ark is carried off into Philistine captivity in 1 Samuel, I believe, chapter 4? And the daughter-in-law of Eli, the judge at the time, she is giving birth. And she has heard that, you know, her husband is dead, her father-in-law is dead, the ark has been captured, and the people are there. They're trying to cheer her up and say, oh, good news, it's a boy. And she names him Ichabod, because the glory has departed Israel. Names are very significant. And sometimes when people have awful situations, they name their kids Ichabod. The glory is departed. But what does he name his children? You know, I don't know what Hebrew name would represent. My life has been the absolute worst. Or I hate my family. But he names his children, God has made me forget all my trouble. God has made me fruitful. Does that sound like someone who's overcome and eaten up with bitterness to you? No, that sounds like someone who has looked at God's grace and mercy and been able to move on with their lives. And when his brothers come to him, it will be a joyful reunion. In chapter 45, beginning in verse 1, after all of the tests have been put before the brothers, then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him, and he cried, have everyone go out from me. So there was no man with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. He wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it, and the household of Pharaoh heard of it. Then Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. Then Joseph said to his brothers, please come closer to me. And they came closer, and he said, I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. Now do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. God sent me before you to preserve you a remnant in the earth and to keep you alive by a great deliverance. Now therefore, it was not you who sent me here, but God, and he has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his household and ruler over all the land of Egypt. And one more verse in Genesis, in chapter 50 and verse 20. As much as Joseph meant it, his brothers, perhaps because of the guilt of their conscience, were not quite sure that he was going to be able to let it go. And so they come to him and try to make sure in verse 17 that they are fully forgiven. But Joseph, in verse 19, says to them, "Do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result to preserve many people alive." Again, I think that those verses, in combination with the kinds of things that he says about his children, tell us all that we need to know about Joseph's perspective. He saw what God had been able to do. He saw what God had done. Now, if you take nothing else from the things that we're saying tonight than this, one of the key points I'm trying to make is that bitterness is a choice. Bitterness is a decision. It is not something that happens to you. It is not something that is thrust upon me against my will. It is a choice that is a result of the way in which I choose to see the events that take place in my life. Bitterness is an attitude that is really paired with a surrendering of choice, because it is steeped in the notion that others have done this to me. Other people have made me the way that I am. Other people have wronged me in this way, and it says nothing about the way in which I choose to react to the events that I'm presented with. And yet here is someone in Joseph. You know, we've presented all of these excuses, and we've presented them with the understanding that usually they're just not true. When people say things like, "No one's on my side," or "Everyone's out to get me," or "I'm all alone," those things aren't true. And yet here's someone in Joseph that this was true. He had every excuse. He could have made the choice to be bitter, but he was able to see things in a different light. And so that sort of segues us into be able to think about how we can be like Joseph in this regard. And if we can sort of elaborate on what we've just said, we need to remember that the excuses that we make for being bitter are not really excuses. Now, they may be what we offer, but is there really any substance to them? Now, I think all of us could answer in the affirmative if we were to ask, have people wronged you before in your life? Have people treated you unfairly? Now, I don't know most of you. I look forward to getting to know you over the next few days. But even though I do not know you, because we live in a fallen world and life is the way that it is, I feel confident in saying that, yes, you have been wronged by someone, probably very seriously, and you have been treated unfairly. And yet then the question that we might pose to ourselves becomes, would you go back and change it if you could? And I want you to understand that that is not just the silly makings of a Hallmark movie. That's a real question to answer. And I think it's one to wrestle with. Because you start to go back and you think, well, here are the chapters in my life that were most difficult, that were the most unpleasant. And if I could have avoided that, I would have loved to do so. But if I skip this chapter here, then I don't get to meet these people that God blessed me with. And if I skip past this chapter over here, then I don't experience this growth. I don't experience this lesson that God was able to teach me. And I don't grow in my faith the way that I grew. In saying that I wish and I could go back and change this or not have to experience, what I am saying is that I wish I could go back and undo all of the good things that God has done in my life in response and to help me get through all of those difficulties. But pairing with that, and I hope this doesn't seem completely out of left field, bitterness is the path to apostasy. And I say that because I want you to understand that this is not a motivational speech about positivity. I'm not just trying to, turn that frown upside down. I'm not saying, every cloud has a silver lining, or whatever trite expression you might bring to mind. Bitterness moves you away from God. Bitterness moves you away from God's people. And that's why we have to understand the gravity of it and appreciate the examples that show us that we can reject it. And that's not some sort of deep thought here. It's pretty common sense. Think about it. Were the Israelites closer to God or further away from God when they complained and murmured and said, "You're just out here to kill us in the wilderness"? Was David closer to God or further away from God when he got so angry with God over the outburst against Uzzah and removing the ark that he didn't even talk to God for some time? Was Judas closer to Christ when he was stewing over the money that he wasn't going to be able to embezzle because it had been wasted on the perfume? I think it's always worth mentioning that in Romans chapter 1, when we have that awful long list of all of the ways in which the world has moved away from God, that it begins with that they didn't give thanks, that people were not thankful. Bitterness blinds us to what God is doing in our lives and what God can do in our lives. Finally, I would simply suggest that as our Christianity, as our discipleship does indeed change our perspective, that we can understand that rejecting bitterness brings us closer to Christ. Sometimes we talk about Joseph as being a type of Christ, as someone who experienced things that would point to Jesus, such as being betrayed by his brethren or saving all of his brethren through his own suffering. And this behavior that we first see in Joseph is later perfected and multiplied in Christ. And this behavior, when we embrace it, we are embracing a part of the character of Jesus. Now, the world doesn't have much to offer in the way of things that are good. But the world does have an awful lot to offer when it comes to bitterness and anger. If you want to be upset about something, the world will give you ammunition and it'll encourage you. But if you want to offer peace, if you want to find peace, there's only one place for that. And that is experiencing a relationship of Jesus Christ that not only forgives us of our sins, but frees us from anxiety and every other ill in which the world would cast upon us. In just a moment, we're going to be singing together. And so as we prepare to do that, we offer the invitation in the light of the things that we've looked at tonight. Again, real peace is found in Jesus Christ, and you have an opportunity to respond to that tonight. Again, not knowing the group very well, it may be that most of those who are assembled are already disciples of Jesus. Maybe you simply want prayers from your brethren here. So if we can help you, if we can encourage you, the invitation is yours as we get to stand and sing.